Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hi, welcome to tonight's Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and with Padraig Reedy. And I'm going to hand over to Padraig, who is going to introduce our guests, Stephanie Merritt and S.J. Paris.
Stephanie Merritt was Deputy Literary Editor of The Observer from 1998 till 2005 and is now a feature writer. She has contributed to a variety of magazines as well as radio and television. She is the author of two novels, Galveston and Real, and one non-fiction book, The Devil Within, and the screenplay for Real, commissioned by Gabriel Byrne's Plurabelle Films. Stephanie's latest book, written under the pseudonym S.J. Paris, is Heresy, a historical murder mystery starring heretic astronomer Giordano Bruno. Stephanie, first of all, congratulations. Heresy is on the New York Times bestseller list.
That's right, yes, this weekend. It's making its first appearance in the New York Times bestseller list. It's just been out a couple of weeks in the States.
So tell us quickly, and obviously not giving it away because it is a thriller, but tell us quickly what it's about.
The main character is, as you said, it's the heretic ex-monk Giordano Bruno, and the book is set in England in 1583. Bruno was a fugitive from the Roman Inquisition. He was a monk, and he had to flee from his monastery in 1576 in Naples because he was charged with reading heretical books. So he went on the run and travelled all through Europe, and he ended up in London in 1583. This is when the book starts, because there is a theory, there's a sort of academic theory that while he lived in England, he was working as a spy for Queen Elizabeth's government under Sir Francis Walsingham. So this is sort of the basic beginning, the premise of the book is that he's there and he's working undercover. And he travels to Oxford to take part in a debate about the theories of Copernicus, the heliocentric universe, which he was a supporter of.
These would have been the heretical books he was reading.
I think he was actually, he had to run, he was caught reading Erasmus in the toilet. That was why he had to go on the run, which was on the Holy Office's index of forbidden books. But yeah, he was very interested in the theories of Copernicus. He was one of the first people to suggest that the universe is infinite. So for all these reasons, he was in big trouble with the Roman authorities. So yes, yeah, so he goes to Oxford, and while he's staying in Oxford, there are a series of fairly grisly murders that take place, and it begins to look as if the killer sort of wants to draw him into this plot and somehow kind of get him involved and get him looking beneath the surface of this Oxford college life, where there is a whole sort of underground resistance going on. So he ends up in this sort of, nest of conspiracies.
Before we go on and talk a bit more about why that character and some of the other characters in the book, let's look at, you know, the very genre of murder mysteries. And you've written literary novels. You've written two novels that would be considered more literary fiction. And now this is a genre novel. So let's talk about the divide between those two things for a bit. Why do you think one is seen as being somehow less worthy?
It's interesting to me because I grew up reading tons of detective fiction. My mother was a big fan of detective fiction, and all through my teens I used to read voraciously through sort of P.D. James, Ruth Rendell, Colin Dexter, Sherlock Holmes, you know, all of the sort of classic detective fiction. And I loved it. And then when I remember very clearly when I sort of put that to one side, it was when I was applying to university and I was told that at my interview I would be asked what I read in my spare time, and if I were to say crime fiction. I wouldn't be doing myself any favours. So that was when I sort of discovered that there is this this fairly artificial division between genre fiction and what's regarded as literary fiction. And it's something that there's actually a very interesting book by P.D. James that's just recently come out called Talking About Detective Fiction, and she's a passionate defender of the detective novel, and she speaks up in favour of the idea that actually it can, although there are certain conventions and you're writing to a particular structure, it's quite possible for a good writer to explore all sorts of notions of society and class and human psychology through the device of a detective novel. So for many years, kind of for 3 years of an English degree and then a decade of working as a professional critic, broadsheet critic, I sort of put crime fiction to one side, and I did buy into this sort of slight snobbery about it. And it was only, I suppose it's partly because there is a bit of a crisis in literary fiction at the moment. I mean, it's becoming increasingly difficult for booksellers and publishers to make literary novels sell in the kind of numbers that they need to. By contrast, there's quite a healthy market for crime fiction. So because this is what I do for a living and I've got, a family to support, I thought, well, I might as well have a go at writing a book that might, sell a few copies. And I think, it was partly I liked the idea of the challenge that you might sort of set out to write a particular type of novel and see if you can make it successful. And
wanted to sort of look at some of the reasons why there might be a crisis in literary fiction. I mean, do you think there are two sort of sides to this? Perhaps one that says that the audience for this sort of thing has sort of dumbed down and just isn't interested in that sort of thing anymore. But could it also be that just, there's just not a lot of good stuff being written or something?
I don't think it's the latter at all. I mean, I think there is plenty of good novelists out there. I think it's partly, well, God, there's all sorts of, cultural reasons, I suppose. I mean, I think our attention span has got shorter. I think there's a sort of constant connectivity and certainly younger generations of kids are growing up not reading, sitting down to read a book is quite alien to the experience of most kind of under 25s now, to sit down and read a whole book. In fact, The Onion had a brilliant spoof the other day where it was, about America paralysed by, uninterrupted block of text with no videos embedded and no kind of click on links. So I think there's that. I think what's happened partly is that all these things become sort of self-perpetuating, but I think when you get bookshops selling bestsellers or, books that are going to sell anyway at massively discounted prices, it immediately choice gets narrowed. I think it's quite hard for new authors to break through if they're not writing for a ready market, and, publishers won't take on books now that they know they can't get into Waterstones. It's a difficult time, and there are a handful of writers who are making an absolute mint from writing literary fiction. But conversely, the sort of mid-range, people who used to publish mid-range literary fiction, they're dropping off at the bottom of the scale because they're just not able to get books commissioned anymore. And it's got nothing to do with the quality of the writer. And I think there's all sorts of, I think celebrity memoirs, biography, all these other genres that have sold in massive numbers are affecting publishers' willingness to take a risk on new voices.
Let's look back at I think is an artificial divide between the so-called literary fiction and genre fiction, because clearly within something like genre fiction there is, although somebody like Umberto Eco is probably not a great example, but there's clearly a massive gulf between Umberto Eco and Dan Brown or something, for instance, Yeah, both of those things would be, could be considered to be writing historical sort of adventure fiction or something.
Yeah, I think that sort of illustrates very well how artificial this concept of calling, grouping things into a particular genre is, because within that, within the thriller genre or within the crime genre, I mean, there are all sorts of people who I think are sort of stylistically brilliant, are doing work that is just as original and inventive and challenging within a particular form. I mean, I think Robert Harris is a brilliant writer. I think Matthew Pearl, who writes historical thrillers, is a superb stylist. There's a, Umberto Eco, as you say, Ian Pears has written a sort of mystery stories, historical mystery stories. Arturo Pérez Reverte and the Spanish writer has done very kind of intelligently written, brilliantly plotted murder mysteries. So there's a, you know, I think within that genre, it's somebody with the right sort of interest and talent can, you know, I don't think it's reductive at all.
You wrote in The Observer a couple of weeks ago, you know, about this kind of realisation of the split and mentioned other people such as John Banville, who writes, you know, what genre fiction and literary fiction. I'm curious, is there, you know, when you approach the page or sit down in front of your laptop, do you have to constantly get it into a different mindset when writing different types of book?
Not really. I think the biggest difference that I've noticed with writing this, because this is a series, so I'm now sort of writing the second one, and this one's just come out. The biggest difference I've noticed is the emphasis on plotting. I think with sort of literary fiction, in quotes, there can be more of a focus on the language and on the psychology, and you can sort of spend more time being concerned about the language that you're using and the way that you're phrasing things. And actually, and I think, you know, very good literary fiction can do that, can describe a fairly uneventful, you know, moment in someone's day and describe it beautifully. But with this kind of fiction, it's all about the plot. You know, the plot's got to drive the story, and you can't really waste words, and you can't really have any, you know, you can't have too much reflection. Obviously, you want your, or I certainly wanted my detective character, Bruno, to be a kind of thinking, feeling, you know, somebody who stops and reflects and has a bit of a conscience and is sort of constantly coming up against moral dilemmas. But you can't have too much interior. You know, I think that's the difference. You know, the literary novel spends a lot of time inside the characters' minds, and you can't do too much of that with a thriller or a crime novel. You've got to keep, the plot's got to keep driving it forward. So that's been the biggest learning curve, I think, with this.
Is it more of a well, journalistic in a sense, style of writing, that, you know, you have to get to the important bits?
I wouldn't say it was journalistic, but I think it's got to be very carefully structured. It's not, I think with the previous novels that I've written, I sort of, you know, they kind of found their own course in a way, and I would be writing it and sort of not quite know where it was going to end up, but not quite how it was going to get there. Whereas with these crime novels, I've had to plot it quite carefully beforehand and write to a structure. So it's more technical, I suppose, in that way. But I don't feel that it's journalistic in that way.
But I think that what you say now also highlights another one of the, you know, the ludicrousness of this artificial divide, in that genre fiction basically stands or falls on its plot and that working and the story being any good, which is, again, something that you can be a bit more lax with if you're writing something that you're writing for the language, etc., do you think?
Yeah, I think one of the things, I think crime fans and, you know, people who buy a lot of crime fiction are very discerning, and I think, you know, they are sort of quite demanding as a readership, and if your plot is slack, you know, or if you don't give them a kind of satisfying resolution at the end, then, you know, they'll give you very short shrift, I think, because, you know, there's not, you're right, it's got to have certain elements to it, and it's got to follow a particular, there is a sort of structure, and, you know, one of the things that you expect in a decent thriller is that there will be some kind of resolution, or maybe some sort of, not necessarily justice, but you'll get a sort of a conclusion at the end. And with, you know, but then actually, when you stop and think, you know, literary, what they call literary fiction does need to be, it's got to have a good story eye as well, because if it's just rambling, it doesn't matter how beautiful the language is, it's not, people won't kind of get involved with it.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and with Padraig Greedy today, and we're talking to Stephanie Merritt about her new book, Heresy. So, Stephanie, why Giordano Bruno, then? What sort of drew you to that character?
Oh, I read about Bruno. I just came across a sort of passing reference to him years ago when I was at university, and I was studying Elizabethan literature. And I found a reference to him, and I couldn't believe that nobody had used him in a novel before in a major way, because I thought he had such an incredibly rich life. You know, he was this very progressive thinker who started off as a monk, and then, as I say, he, you know, he had to flee his monastery, and at the time you couldn't leave the Dominican order without permission, so he was then automatically excommunicated. So he was always sort of keeping one step ahead of the Inquisition, and he went on the run through Italy. But what was amazing about him was that, having gone from, you know, he left his monastery as absolutely nothing, was a fugitive for several years, and managed to work his way up. He sort of crossed into, went to Geneva and then into France, and he ended up as kind of personal philosopher to the King of France. So he was obviously this incredible talker, and he's, there are contemporary accounts that say that everybody wanted him at their kind of dinner table because he was, you know, he was just incredibly entertaining, and it's somebody that you wanted to be around. And I thought, well, he must have been very charismatic to have got to that stage. And yet also someone who had these, for the time, quite bizarre and heretical ideas about the universe, about God, about, you know, but our place, man's place in the universe. And, you know, and then this whole life of, sort of travelling and living in exile. And I just thought he was such a rich and complex character that I always wanted to write something about him. And but it wasn't until, it was a couple of years ago when I sort of came to thinking about trying to write a historical novel, and I came to I came across this theory that he'd worked as a spy, and that was it. I thought, oh, that's the kind of philosopher's stone for me. That was what set it all off.
Well, another one of the you know the things that a crime novel, detective novel, will stand and fall on, of course, is the sort of, is the, you know, the appeal of the central character to the audience.
Yeah, and I think he's sort of the perfect. You know, I think he's got the qualities of a lot of the kind of great fictional detectives, which is, you know, and I can sort of say that because, I mean, I'm saying that about him as a historical character, not necessarily as I've imagined. Although I hope I've done him justice. I mean, I think I've kind of airbrushed out some of the, you know, less appealing aspects of his nature, because you want him to be likable to the reader. But he's necessarily an outsider. You know, he's operating in a time where, you know, people are in two tribes, basically. It's particularly in England, 1580s England, you know, the tension between Catholics and Protestants is what defines everyone, really. And he's neither. You know, he's been excommunicated by the Catholic Church. He's not officially a Protestant. He's got his own, you know, quite bizarre philosophy that he's sort of developing at the time that he's in England, because that's when he wrote some of his major works. Actually, most of his major works were written in England. So he's an outsider, he's an exile, he's living in the house of the French ambassador, who is the sort of focal point for various kind of anti-Protestant plots, although that sort of comes into the next book more. But even in Oxford, he's a foreigner, he's sort of derided for being a foreigner, but that allows him to stand outside and sort of gain confidence of people on both sides.
Let's talk about some of the historical background, and particularly Sir Francis Walsingham, who is the Elizabeth's sort of spy master, basically. Yeah. What did you find appealing about him?
Well, he's there are some very good biographies of Walsingham around, and he was actually this incredible character. He more or less single-handedly set up the sort of beginnings of modern intelligence, because at the time there'd been a papal bull sort of about 10 years before the story starts, excommunicating Elizabeth I and denouncing her as a heretic. And it wasn't quite a fatwa, you know, the equivalent of that. But it pretty much said that any Catholic who assassinated Elizabeth wouldn't be a sin. And as a result, there were various Catholic plots during the 1580s to assassinate Elizabeth, right up until because Mary Queen of Scots, who was her cousin, was a Catholic. So the idea was that if Elizabeth was assassinated, Mary would be the next heir to the throne, which would make England Catholic again. So Walsingham, and also there were these seminaries around France and the Low Countries that were training up young men to be missionary priests to come in to England undercover. So there's Walsingham basically sets up this whole network of spies and informers all over the country and in France, and to bring him back this intelligence that it allowed them to preempt several assassination attempts on Elizabeth, which was quite extraordinary at the time. And it interested me because there's so much that you read about what was happening then that has echoes in what's going on now. I mean, you've got the problem of when you pay informers, or when you pardon people's debts in order if they will go back you let Catholics, you find known Catholics, you give them a pardon if they will go back and sort of grass on their former conspirators. And so all this is going on, but obviously when there's a financial incentive, you can't guarantee the quality of the information you're getting. There's also the use of torture. They use torture to get information that they wanted out of suspects. So there's all sorts of parallels with kind of religious tensions and fear of assassinations going on.
And what torture? I mean, the some of the stuff that's described in this book. I mean, not only the murders, but we won't talk about because people should go and buy the book and find that for themselves. But you know, the way that the heretics were, you talk about one, Edward Campion, who was one of the...
He was sort of one of the most famous of the Jesuit missionaries who came in, and he was informed against eventually. He sort of did quite a tour, did a kind of preaching tour around England before he was caught. And, I mean, that's interesting. They used to, they executed heretics. Heretics were hung, drawn and quartered. Sorry, I've got that wrong. Priests were hung, drawn and quartered because that was the punishment for traitors. Heretics were burned at the stake, but Walsingham and Elizabeth and the rest of her advisors, they wanted... There's very interesting because a lot of it's about propaganda and kind of, you know, spin, and they didn't want to kind of inflame their Catholic subjects, because there was obviously quite, you know, pockets of quite strong Catholic resistance where people were just accepting Protestantism in name. So they didn't want to make martyrs. So they were very clear that they were executing these Catholics as traitors to the realm, as people who were endangering the safety of the realm rather than killing them for their faith. Because, you know, if you kill someone for their faith, that makes them a martyr. So that's why heretics were sort of disemboweled rather brutally and the rest of it. Yeah.
Well, Giordano Bruno is not, you know, it's not really giving anything away about the eventual story today. He's a famous historical figure, and at some point in the future is going to find himself burnt at the stake himself, isn't he?
He's dead now, that's what you can... he is dead, sorry to say.
So, let's talk about how you sort of set up writing and what's going to be a series of books, and obviously at some point in the future, that's not a secret that that's going to happen.
No, I mean, you know, but Bruno's life story, there was quite a good biography came out in the States last year, and there's plenty on Wikipedia you can find about him. So, and the books are going to be based, you know, the structure, the kind of infrastructure at least of this series is sticking quite closely to the facts about his travels and where he was at particular times. But we're in the first one, so we're in 1583, he's 35, he's not executed until 1600, so there's actually quite... And he, you know, after England, he goes back to Paris, then to Germany, then to Prague, then back to Italy. So there's lots of scope for him to have some more adventures along the way.
I think Bruno, I mean, he's... you know, you said you came across him at university, and he's a largely kind of forgotten figure. Is that just the case in England, or, you know, is he better known in the continent?
Yeah, he's huge in Italy, actually. He became a big sort of, what's the word? You know, he was a kind of rallying cry in the 19th century. He was sort of rehabilitated, and Victor Hugo, there was sort of various leading intellectuals of the time subscribed to have this statue of him erected in the Campo dei Fiori, which is where he was in Rome, which is where he was burned. So there is this rather beautiful and kind of melancholic statue of him there, and every year on the anniversary of his execution, people go and put flowers and pin little notes on his statue. So he is, I think in on the continent he is celebrated more. I mean, he's certainly much better known than he is here, but he's it's curious because he is one of these people who's become sort of all things to all men. There are people who will revere him as a kind of, you know, people who think that he was the first martyr for free thought, because it was really, you know, he was in the end condemned to death by the Inquisition because he wouldn't retract these theories that he had about Christianity. And yet he was very interested in kind of ancient magic. You know, he had lots of sort of quite esoteric philosophy. So the idea that he's this sort of champion of modern science is slightly off, I think. But he's just very, very interesting in that he brings all those things together.
And the celebration of him in Europe, would that be coming from a slightly kind of anti-clerical angle, or do you think?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Because he's, he's seen as a bit of a rebel as well, which is, he undoubtedly was at every stage. And he was, in the novel I've got, you know, Francis Walsingham, when he first meets him, he said, I was intrigued to meet you. I've never met anyone else who managed to get himself condemned as a heretic by the Calvinists and the Inquisition. So, yeah, he managed to sort of upset everyone along the way.
Well, we're nearly out of time, but before we finish, I just wanted to talk about... Let's talk about the pseudonym and why the pseudonym, why the name, and what the difference is of writing under one as opposed to in your own name, if there are any.
Well, the reason for... I mean, it's fairly basic, and it's all to do with... and it's a horrible word, but branding. You know, it's not a... It was never a sort of secret. And in fact, there's a big picture of me on the back of the book, so it's not a, it wasn't ever to disguise my identity. It's more a way of saying, this is a departure, and it's going to be a whole, it's going to be a series, and when you see the SJ Paris name, this is what you can expect from it. And it also allows me the freedom to write other things under my own name if I wanted to write something that wasn't about Bruno. So it's a, it's almost like having a coloured sticker on the book just to show that it's a different type of thing. And it's a, I think as we said earlier, it's a sort of tried and tested device. A number of writers have done that and experimented with writing different types of fiction under a different name. It just, it's more of a guide for readers, really.
And have we gone with the SJ because it's gender neutral?
Yeah, there's partly that. Also, it sort of, yeah, it just kind of helps to for, to design the cover. Although in Germany, they are, in Germany, apparently thrillers by women sell very well, so they're using Stephanie Paris, which is sort of neither one thing nor the other. I don't quite know why they're doing that, but they think that will sell it better. So it's, you know, again, it's all to do with what people see when they walk into a bookshop and, you know, how the cover makes it look is very important.
Well, we haven't obviously talked about the book and about the plot and everything at all, really, because obviously we don't want to give it away, but it is, it's absolutely terrific. It does really, really, really grip you. So people should go out and buy Heresy by SJ Paris, and it's out now from HarperCollins. Stephanie, thanks very much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.